Leave the spin doctors at home. Enter the fray of the culture kitsch. Joining me today is the pop culture artist, Mr. Ron English. Stay tuned to the culture kitsch. Joining me today on the Culture Kitsch is the pop culture artist, Ron English. Ron English started his career at the University of Texas in Austin, where he painted billboards of a political agenda.
Actually, my first billboards weren't political at all. They were just, I was using the billboards as a place to display my art, because at that point I wasn't able to get in galleries, so I thought, well, this is, you know, I could get a 10 by 22 foot canvas right there, free for the taking.
That's a great, was it a class project?
No, actually, when I was at UT, they were very nervous about me doing that because they thought, you know, I would get arrested and the implications would come back to them. And if I was turning this in as class projects, that it wouldn't work out too well for them.
But Austin was always a city of liberalism, wasn't it? In a sea of Republican domination.
Except for the art department was very, very straight.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. You would think just the opposite, that there would be the bastion of...
Well, it's a lot of people trying to get tenure and trying to hold on to their jobs and totally scared. And you know, you figure the people that own the university probably don't like a bunch of radicals running around.
And what year was this? Is right after Vietnam or...
Okay, I did the first billboards in like 1982.
Oh, 82, okay. Yeah. So it was after that, but you still had the...
Right. And they, you know, they were just kind of weird surrealistic type of things. Like, you know, good old squirrel squirt beer and just kind of like... Like weird ads, it didn't make any sense.
Right. Well, you're still saying something culturally. That's always been your agenda, hasn't it?
I got more political. Actually, after Austin, I met a lot of political people there, and they were like, well, you know, why don't you do something political on the billboards instead of just showing off your art, you know? And I think that's kind of where I got into that sort of stuff. But
what was the impetus for the very first billboard? What inspired you? Saw this big, huge potential canvas?
Well, the very first one I did two, and I did them for, you know, my now wife, Tarsa, who you've met. But So I drove her to Dallas, and then I left her sitting in the car, and I climbed up these two billboards, and I did one that said love, and then one that said lust, and one that said love. And the one that said lust was a bunch of drooling babies, kind of like, you know, because babies, they don't understand the concept of love. It's all about what can you do for me.
Right.
And then
there
was a bunch of old clowns with painted on smiles, which is kind of the opposite. Somebody who's probably really tragic and sad, but they're still willing to go the extra mile to make another person happy, and that's kind of what love is. And I was trying to explain that. I was transitioning out of being in lust for her to being in love for her, and, you know, my art student-y kind of moronic way, I was trying to say something to her. And then I come back to the car, and I'm like, what do you think? And then she kind of looked up and said, you made me late for work for that. So that was my first
billboard. The scorned artist.
Yeah.
My God.
But I kept doing them, and then other artists started seeing them. And I was doing them more, you know, it's for my photography.
Right.
You know, because they were just kind of backdrops for the photography. And then I didn't really think of them as something that stood on their own.
So you started in photography was your first medium in love?
Right.
Okay.
I did the weird trompe-l'oeil tricks, and I did kind of, I took things out into really harsh environments, like, you know, biker bars or whatever, and I set up my stuff there. Or if I did something outside and there was a billboard in the background, I thought, well, I want that billboard to have something more cool on it than, you know, cool cigarettes.
Right.
I want it to have something that, that relates to my picture. And since all my pictures were, like, no matter how strange they got, it was really what was happening. I never did any kind of manipulation in the darkroom or anything. So I was kind of stuck in a corner where if that billboard was going to end up in the shot, then I had to go change that billboard.
Interesting.
So, but the thing is like, once I'd, you know, done the billboard, then after I've left, then the billboard stayed up, and then a lot of the young painters in Dallas started seeing the billboards, and they actually came to me and said, can we have your permission to do billboards too?
Wow, like, that's interesting.
Well, it was interesting. I don't understand why they asked my permission. Maybe it's because...
An homage. You know,
they thought, well, that's his concept.
Yeah.
So what we did is we formed a group called the New Urban Aesthetics Committee, and then every 2 months we would go to, like, Houston or Austin or San Antonio, and we would just whack out, like, 20 billboards, and then we would get a keg of beer and have an art opening underneath of them that night, you know?
And there'd always be music, because I know with Ron English, there's lots of music involved.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to North Texas, so, like, when in my house, I had this big house with graffiti from top to bottom, and...
You didn't go to University of Texas?
And I didn't have any... Yes, I did. I went there to graduate school.
Oh, for grad school.
But in Denton, I had a big old white house, and then one time I had a graffiti party and let all the artists from the art building come graffiti my whole house from top to bottom.
Really?
And then I didn't have a stereo, because I really never had that much money.
Right.
And then I figured out, well, I could let all these... bands, because, you know, it's a big jazz school and everything, and there were punk bands and everything you could think of there. And I said, well, if I just let them all rehearse in my house, then I always have a band playing, you know. So usually they would rehearse, you know, during the day when I was in class and stuff, and then on the weekends we'd throw big parties, and it would just be constant flow of bands going through there.
Anyone famous?
Michelle Schock played, Daniel Johnson, different people like that. Yeah.
And those people,
I mean,
you stayed in
nobody
contact.
Huge. R.E.M. played, but they actually played. I had a party in Dallas. I had an opening, and they I was a sitting in the office before the opening, and I was, again, going to have a couple of my friends' bands play at the opening to kind of get more people to come in.
Right.
You know, art doesn't attract that many people. But, yeah, so I'm sitting in there, and then the phone rings.
Sure it does. You're a very successful, well-heeled artist
these
days.
You don't pack them in, you know,
right,
like musicians do.
True.
But, yeah, so the phone rings. And
art groupies are a little different.
Yeah. I pick up the phone. This guy goes, what's going on there tonight? And I said, oh, I'm having an art opening here, and then a couple bands will be playing. It'll be like a big party. And he goes, wow, that's great. Well, could I play? You know, I have a band. Could I play? And I'm like, well, what's your band? He goes, oh, I have a band called R.E.M. Could we come play? Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Michael Stipe. Let me introduce myself. And I'm like, okay, sure, come play. You know, it's a relaxed atmosphere. And then you know, he said, okay. And then he hung up. And then the phone rings again. He goes, Ron, it's Michael again? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, there will be beer there, right? Yeah, there'll be lots of beer. So, but yeah, I had a lot
sex,
of wild
drugs,
people
and rock play. And roll, man. You got to have it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was good co-opting then, because, as we know, you know, the art chicks are probably into the music as well, and so if you could juxtapose and co-opt those two synergies, I guess traditionally for the artist of our generation, music is a big influence, or there's a big crossover.
Yeah, it seems like that musicians or artists are a lot more aware of musicians than musicians are aware of artists.
Oh.
You know, because most artists, I think, just have just big piles of CDs, and they're in a situation where if you're just sitting there painting for 8 hours a day, you get an opportunity to listen to a lot more music than somebody working in their office that couldn't really crank it up, you know.
Right. Well, in the early days, who were some of your favorite artists?
Painters?
Or, yeah.
You know what really attracted me to painting was because I was doing the photo thing, and I just thought painting was kind of at a dead end, you know. And I think when the guys like Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf,
all the New York guys,
it seemed young and fun, and it seems like here's people that were actually raised on color TV and think like I do are finally making some paintings and pushing, you know, the envelope on what painting can be.
Right.
You know. So.
And you like their position in pop culture and the nomenclature they were using.
Or you know, like when I first learned about art, it was like, you know, like when Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg and those guys happened, they did. Like store windows and stuff, and they did commercial art, and then they had to do it under a fictitious name because they would burn their credibility in the high art world.
Right.
And these guys came in, and they were too young to understand the rules of the art world, and they just broke them all over the place. And then,
but it's interesting that Warhol would be allowed to do that and dabble in so many things as a Renaissance guy.
Yeah.
And yet, an artist like Rauschenberg, although later in his life, I remember a classic Talking Heads album that he designed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that I think the thing with Warhol and why artists adore Warhol is because he really did change all the rules. And he had already gotten himself into such big collections that they couldn't eradicate him. And then when he started doing things that he wasn't supposed to do,
right,
like making lunchboxes or producing the Velvet Underground or whatever, that he was already too entrenched, you know?
And they couldn't say anything. The critics loved them by then, right?
Right. You know, now the big problem with him is that he overproduced.
What's the difference between him and somebody like Kostabi, who tried to co-opt the Warhol thing, and for a while it kind of worked, and now it's like, I don't know, he kind of fell out of favor, didn't he, in the community?
It happened really fast for him, and he was a different kind of character, I don't know. You know, I think the one thing that really hit him hard in the New York art world was when he told the guy from Vanity Fair, it's like, you know, I think that AIDS is a good thing because it only affects homosexuals, and they do nothing to perpetuate the species anyway, And people just thought, you know, it's like he's always doing something to get in the press, pushing it to another level. But at some point, it's like, you're an asshole.
Right.
You know, it's not funny anymore. It's like, it's, you know what I mean? Especially when AIDS was hitting really hard and everybody was scared and they didn't know how hard it was going to hit or where it was going to end. And just to be that, you know, it's, I don't know, humor is a funny thing.
Can't be insensitive. Or if you're going to be insensitive, you got to be ready for the backlash.
And the backlash was huge. And then he was really huge in Japan and he got a backlash because he hired a guy, Andy Berman, to make his, you know, to be his representative in Japan. And then he went to all of his clients in Japan, who were buying like 100 paintings at a time.
Wow.
And said, look, you know, now you're going to deal with Andy. And he wanted Andy because he was a blue blood and, you know, and I think Kostabi was kind of a lower class guy and he wanted to hook into that, you know, old money thing. And what this guy did was, you know, when everybody called up from Japan to say, we want 70 paintings, you know, and he would say, okay. And then, but, you know, there's a new account number. And he would give him his account number, and then he came upstairs to where all the painters were, and he got one woman, Beata, to says, well, would you make these paintings, you know? And she agreed, and she made them out here in Jersey City. This went on for a while, and he was in Japan and with his girlfriend, and he didn't really speak Japanese, and she was going through the papers. He says, oh, look, Mark, you have a show. Oh, my God, look, you have two shows. And he goes, I don't have any shows in Japan. And they went into the shows, and there was just like these huge shows of Kostabi that he had nothing to do with. He didn't. But I mean, the funny thing about him is like first he was I don't paint them. Then he was like I don't paint them, and I don't have the ideas for them. And it finally got down to where, you know, I don't paint them, I don't have the ideas for them, and I don't get the money for them either. So
well, you worked.
It was
for
like
him
a logical
how long
progression.
Did you work for him?
I actually ended up working off and on for 5 years. Yeah.
Wow, that's a pretty long time. So you really. These are stories of truth.
Yeah, but you know,
from the trenches.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I would have done if he would have came up and said, "Do you want to make fakes?" And I mean, I might have said yes, but thankfully, I wasn't there.
Well, Warhol had his minions do a lot of his work. I mean, he might have executed an idea, but they carried out the actual working.
Right.
And you know, people don't realize that.
But you know what? They also don't realize that he actually painted every day.
Really?
He did a lot more of the work than people realized. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in the 70s when he started going abroad and taking the Polaroids and then he would ship them back, you know, to America, then Ronnie Catrone would paint them and take care of all the execution of them. And like back to what I was saying before, they're trying to downgrade those.
Mm.
Because the problem is he has so much stuff. It's like nobody knows how many Marilyns he actually made.
Right.
And to make art really, you know, to be able
limited
to get
series.
$20 million for something there can't be 1,000 of them,
right, exactly.
You know?
Well, that's the problem with photography, as you know. Yeah. You know, you destroy the negative after you've taken the great picture.
Right.
And how many prints get made off of that negative.
Right. But, you know, the same thing was happening with Warhol. Once he would go home at night, then the guys would pull out the screen and screen some of their own. And, you know, they still sell them to this day. You know, a lot of them kept the screen.
Right. When you moved to New York, were you surprised by what you saw in the art scene?
You know, I think when you move to New York, you think that I'm going to be best friends with Keith Haring, I'm going to hang around with Sean Lennon, and that, you know, all the stuff you read about, you think you're going to be a part of it, and initially that you're not a part of it, you know? And then when finally, years later, you are a part of it, you don't have any perception of being a part of it, do you know what I mean?
So you went through the Kostabi door, and that kind of got you into camp.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I picked him because I didn't know how to paint. I was a photographer when I moved here. And when I got here, I thought, fuck it, I don't want to be a photographer anymore. It's like, I want to be a painter, because I was getting excited about
painting. Are you serious?
Really?
You didn't take, come on, you were in art school, so you were painting.
I was in, I got a graduate degree in art photography. And
at
the time I got the degree, there was not a person on this planet that made their sole living off of art photography. You know, Jerry Uelsman was a teacher down in Florida. Dwayne Michaels was was a commercial photographer in New York. I mean, everybody had some other gig, and then they just showed in galleries to kind of, you know.
Now that's a little different with La Chapelle and some of the other guys.
I think maybe like Serrano was one of the first ones to really just be, you know, where it was being accepted as art,
right.
You know, and it got really big, you know, and it's all timing, you know. I mean, I about the time I segued out of it, it actually sort of started finding its own,
right.
You know.
Right.
But in the end, it's like, you know, painting, I thought, was just, you know, that's like the big sport, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you want to be in football instead of, you know, croquet, you know what I mean?
Well, if you're in New York City, you're right, unless it was music.
Well, I mean,
but there was probably more at that time in the 80s. There was more money to be made in the art scene for sure.
All the
East Village art galleries and everything that was happening was exploding.
Right, but actually, I came in 86, so it was at the end of the party, and people were like, "Oh my God, you should have been here last year." It's like, thanks, pal. But you know, when you're in Texas, you don't have any. You know, I came up here and hung out and went to parties and stuff, but you have a kind of a sense that this will go on forever.
Right.
And I'm going to hang around for 2 more years in Texas and get a graduate degree in case things don't work out. I can be a teacher,
right.
You know?
Right.
And then when you don't realize that things actually go in waves, you know, and that whatever was going on was over by the time I got here, so.
So what was your first big break?
You know, I think the thing that really turned everything around for me was getting the Absolute English ad.
Yeah.
And I went in, you know, because they just did Morehall, and then they did Herring, and then they did Scharf. And I thought, man, you know, maybe I could do that. And so I got an interview with Michelle Roux, right?
Right.
And I got that because I actually wrote for a magazine in Dallas. So they actually called the magazine to make sure I really wrote for them and everything. And I went under the pretense of doing an article. And, you know, I asked them a couple questions. And I finally said, look, the real reason I'm here is, and I pulled out my Absolute painting. And he goes, show me some other work you have. And I pulled it out, and he goes, you're in. And I thought he might go for it because, you know, I mean, he must have pulled stunts like that, too, to get to the top. You know what
right.
I mean? It's kind of like you got to break the rules a little bit to move ahead.
Right.
You know, if you just stay in line, you know, the line's a long line.
Maybe Kris Kristofferson landed a helicopter in Johnny Cash's backyard, they say.
Yeah,
I've
heard that.
And gave his tapes.
Yeah.
So, you know,
you know, if a guy does that, you're going to listen to his tapes,
yeah.
Right?
Well, you're going to think he's going to hold me hostage if I
don't. Yeah.
But I'm still amazed that you really taught yourself to paint working at the Kostabi factory.
Well, that was helpful, and you know, because of people like Claude Sicaro, who was trained to paint like Rembrandt, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and different people came into there with different skill sets, and I was able to. And you learn by doing something. You learn by like, how come this isn't working?
Mm-hmm.
And they can say, well, here's what you're doing. You got to put a lot of turp in it. You got to let it dry for about 10 minutes, and now you can put this on top. And this is the only way it's going to work. And you're like,
right.
Wow. How would I have known that? And even in art school, all my friends that studied painting, they said they never really were taught anything. They just did critiques, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, they learned how to talk about art, you know, which if you think of your art teacher, it's like you want to waste a lot of time trying to show everybody all these idiot little techniques. You want to just, like, twice a week, let's all get together, let's put all of our paintings out, light a couple cigarettes, and let's talk about art, you know? And it's like group therapy, you know? I mean, sometimes they'd talk about, like the teacher would talk about his suicidal tendencies for an hour, you know? And,
right.
Where else could you get away with that, you know, art school?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, I mean, in a way, it was a lucky thing for me. But, you know, even Mark finally told me to leave. I mean, you know, he said, look, I don't know why you're still here. You know, these people are coming in saying, I want to buy a Kostabi, but I want one painted by English, you know. And it's like, I shouldn't be telling you this, but it's like, you know, you should probably, you know.
That's very righteous.
You should probably move on. I mean, he was, you know, he's a smart, nice guy. He just kind of. Shot himself in the foot. But,
right.
I mean, it's also, you know, when you're young, you want to be famous, like, very young, and you don't quite understand what the pitfalls of it are. You don't
right.
give a shit. You just want to be famous, you
right.
know? And you realize, like, a lot of these people that got too big too fast made a lot of paintings that they're probably not very proud of, and now they have to see those floating around. They have no control over them anymore. You know, like, all my early paintings, you know, I threw them in the dumpster, you know what I mean? Until I got to a level where I was proud of it, you
mm-hmm.
know? And now all the paintings, like, if I go somewhere and I see one of my paintings, I'm like, they can... That's fucking good. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and also I wasn't, you know, I was more politically aware and I wasn't going to say completely outrageous, stupid things, you know, and torpedo myself, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said for it coming a little later, you know.
Sure.
Although one thing I did that was kind of really got me into a lot of trouble was that trying to have the most songs about me. Remember that?
Why did that get you into trouble? And tell the people out there what the concept was.
Okay, well, the concept was, actually what happened was my Manhattan studio burnt down. And so I had, like, what ended up being 6 months, but I wasn't sure how long it was going to be, where I just moved to Hoboken to a little apartment while they're rebuilding my loft, and I had nothing to do. And so I started going to see bands, and then I thought, well, you know, I can't really play an instrument or be in a band, but it's like they were, it was just so cool that I thought, how can I be a part of this? And then after, you know, seeing bands one night, we were just sitting in our house and we watched a documentary about Saddam Hussein. And it said that, you know, he was actually the living person that had the most songs about him, you know.
I thought, well, I had no idea.
Yeah, he had the most songs about him, any living person. You know, the dead person, Jesus Christ obviously has more songs, you know, but, right. But of a living person, Saddam Hussein, most songs.
Wow.
And I thought, well, you know what, I could go ask these bands to write a song about me, and then I could put out a record of it, and you know, or a couple records until, like, I beat Saddam's
record. I seem to remember
record.
That.
Yeah. And I, you know, it was interesting to me, because, like, at the time, I was, like, really into Andy Kaufman and stuff, uh-huh. You know, and I just liked the fact that you never knew what the fuck he was up to, or if he took himself seriously, or if he was just pulling your leg, or if he wasn't, or...
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting, because mostly, you know, people, you know what they're doing. You know, with him, it was just, you never knew.
It was always
I thought
sideways.
That was really neat. So yeah. Is this guy like the world's biggest egomaniac, or is he kind of making a joke about it, egomaniacs? Or, you know, you can never be really sure what I was up to. And also, you would never be sure what, you know, people would do. I mean, they could write a song called, and they did, you know, I fucked Ron English up the ass, or whatever, you know. It's like, you know what, we'll put it on. Don't worry about it. You know, right. Whatever you want to do, we'll do, you know. So it was an interesting experiment. It's also interesting to walk up to bands and say, you know, hey man, my name is Ron, would you write a song about me? And they're like,
and now
but the funny part is there are these social lines that you're not supposed to cross that everybody kind of inherently is aware of, but you don't know, it's never talked about, because bands constantly say, would you do my album cover? I'd like a close-up of my face looking really intense. And if you get that, they're like, oh my god, you know, you did the Dandy Warhol's album cover, that's so cool. But if I ask them to write a song about me, then I'm an asshole. If I'm asked to do a painting about them, it's like, where did that come from, you know?
And why is that? What's your...
I don't know.
What's your thing on that?
I don't know.
Is it too much a celebration of me?
You know, I mean, nobody begrudges Beck for putting his face on all of his album covers and having the record company stamp out millions and millions of copies of
right.
it, you know?
That's why you've had 4 Ron English albums.
Yeah.
Without regret. And the bands all want to do it. I'm just bummed you haven't asked me to do another one since the first one.
Well, I mean, I don't do that anymore. But, I mean, if I was in a band, I would say sure. I think it would be funny.
Yeah, you know? I think it's great.
But, you know, I like to think I have a good sense of humor about everything.
Well, I know a painter. His stuff is pretty odd. With Mickey Mouse's Maryland and hell, this is God. I'm not an artist. I don't understand that stuff. But he'll explain it to me if he's drunk enough. Ron English. Ron English is a painter who will make it in the 90s, I know. Cause he told me so. I don't go to art openings, what purpose would it serve? Unless I hear they're serving free wine and hors d'oeuvres. But I'll go to an English show if one is in town, ignoring all the paintings like the rest of the crowd. Ron English. Ron English. Ron English is a painter who will make it in the 90s, I know. Cause he told me so. Can make a dream come true. So I'm going to Madonna in the 1990s to Ron English. Ron English. Ron English is a painter who will make it in the 90s, I know. Cause it told me so.
my kids just went on the Disney cruise, right? I told you that, right?
So I was appalled by that.
She refused to have her picture made with Mickey Mouse. And I haven't got to ask her why yet, because she's still not back. But it's like, you know, I'm also thinking, you know, if she took a really good picture with Mickey Mouse, I couldn't make a poster of that. I mean, it's not my image, because it's tainted, because it's got Mickey Mouse in it. Or if I take a great picture of the kids at the beach and one of them's wearing a Mickey shirt, it's like, now that's not my image.
Right.
It's Disney's image. And it's like, I thought, wow, you know, these guys can saturate, you know, the culture with this image, and then everywhere their image appears, it becomes theirs. You know, it's like you constantly see people have to blur stuff out because somebody's wearing a Mickey shirt. It's like they just have this cultural domination. And but we're not allowed to draw Mickey Mouse, you know?
Right.
And so I just thought, you know, and what happened was they asked me to be in a book called The Art of Mickey Mouse, where they got all these people to do a painting of Mickey Mouse, all these famous artists. And I did one, and they said, well, you know, that painting implies that Mickey just had sex. And I'm like, yeah, duh. You know,
and they're like, go figure.
Mickey doesn't have sex. We don't let our mouse
no
portray
genitalia.
That. Like, and then they kicked me out of the book. But, you know, it's,
and they were dead serious
but,
about it.
But everybody that had their book, they had them sign a thing that said you can never paint Mickey Mouse ever again, which I'd never thought of painting Mickey Mouse or ever would want to. And so, like, in a way, it was a blessing that they wouldn't let me in the book. But then I thought, you know what? Fuck you and fuck your mouse. And then I just started... You know, the first thing I
co-opting think, every chance you
yeah.
got.
Put Mickey in a mouse trap, you know, and you
do you
know,
still get letters from him?
I've gotten in trouble with them, but they had to back down because, you know, it's like, unless I, you know, put it on T-shirts, which, or if I really merged it out, then I could, you know, get into trouble. But, you know, right now it's, legally, I'm cool because, you know, nobody in the right mind would think that Disney put out this T-shirt. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's really the litmus test is would somebody look at that, would a reasonable person, you know, not a dimwit, but a reasonable person look at that and think, Disney did that? I mean, automatically people know that I'm making fun of Disney, and then that's very protected speech at this point. You know, maybe after the new administration gets to tinker with some stuff.
Well.
It won't be.
We'll go there in a second, but, you know, why... I mean, but that's the nature of art. The nature of art is to say, this is society. Let's look inward so we can look outward. And you're taking these images that are so saturated. I mean, look at the Warhol imagery that you use. You know, his Polaroid print things that he painted. I mean, that's a big part of your work. The Maryland thing is an icon. You know, everything is icon-driven in America. Marketing seems to run everything.
Well, it's almost like the advertisements have become... not monuments, but like almost like the Grand Canyon. It's like they're more prevalent than the Grand Canyon.
Right.
You know, and if you don't address it, it's like, you know, I always say that, you know, I mean, Cezanne, those guys all looked out their window and saw a big mountain, and then they tried to interpret that mountain in their own way. And when I look out the window, I see, you know, a 400-foot Calvin Klein ad.
Right.
You know? And to ask me not to address that, you know, is totalitarian.
And propaganda is kind of manifesto. That's your thinking.
It's my one-word manifesto.
It is. It truly is. I think it's great. I think it's a brilliant manifesto, propaganda. It says it all.
What everybody's waiting to see is what happens, because in the last couple of years I introduced all my own characters, you know, mostly because I can't license this.
Right.
Right.
So you have to have the Ron English characters. So, kind of look, maybe not.
So anyway, it'll be interesting to see if people start making fun of my characters as they get more famous. You know.
Well, how would you?
But the rule of thumb is until something's kind of media saturation, you're not supposed to touch it.
What would you do with these characters? How would you get them into the marketplace? Cuddly dolls and video game characters.
The Rabbit comes out this fall as a. Now you said we're not going to be promoting our products in our.
You bastard! Look at this, man. You're cheapening the show.
Yes, but
go ahead. Plug. Shameless plug.
Okay, the Rabbit comes out from Dark Horse this fall.
Love Dark Horse.
The Fat Ronald. You know, the supersized Ronald McDonald comes out through Toy Tokyo,
uh-huh.
And then Strange Co. is putting out the cowgirl with the udder breast and
the udder breast. That's classic.
Well, you know, I was thinking about like our relationship with cows. You know, and you know, we drink their milk, we feed it to our kids, we eat them. We've domesticated them, you know, I mean, they're docile. We don't have to hunt them anymore. So we have this strange relationship with cows. And then I wanted to sexualize it, too, so it's real creepy. So it's like, and you know, if you make a woman this beautiful, there's nothing a man can do about it. They're going to lust after them, but then they're going to see the cow head and the cow udders, you know, so it's going to be a very conflicting, strange
right.
image for them. And the weird thing about the male mind is there's nothing you can do. I mean, if you see a beautiful woman, there's it doesn't
it's
matter.
DNA, baby. I tell my wife it's the Viking gene.
Yeah, I mean, believe me, you wouldn't be making kids with your wife if you didn't have that. So they got to appreciate it on some level.
Right.
But, you know, but it's just interesting. It's like a trigger in the brain that you can't turn off.
How big is the figure going to be, life size?
Yeah. Actually, she's only going to be like 10 inches.
Damn it.
She's a toy.
Oh, that kind of toy.
But also I wanted to get some toys out while my kids were still kids.
Right.
So that they could have some of my toys instead of Disney toys.
Yeah. You know? They must just hate you, Ron English.
No, they don't care. They don't seem to have any interest. You know, I guess because they always... The only thing that
Because they know they draw attention to you by doing that,
well,
which
sometimes
is good.
I make them be in all my paintings, right. And I have since they were little kids. And I considered it lucky that, you know, because I started doing it because, you know, one wants to do stuff with their kids.
Or you did the Great Kiss
I did a lot of Kiss and
with
a lot
your,
of clown
With your
kids
son, which is great.
And, but yeah, like my son the other day said, I don't want to be in your paintings anymore, but I'll still be on the billboards.
Okay. He wants more exposure, Ryan.
Yeah. Well, they you know, like the daughter's like, how come, like you get in a magazine, right? So how come, you know, like there's five pictures of Mars and only one picture of me? And I'm like, but you're on the cover. That's better than 10 pictures in the magazine. They're like, shit. Oh.
God, I think you have a future agent in the family. He's understanding the business.
Well, I'm hoping she becomes an artist. I think that would be a lot of fun. Because that could certainly push her ahead of the game.
Well, I don't care much for the visual arts. You won't find me in a gallery looking for the answers to life in dry paint when there's something better on TV. But there is one artist that I admire. You know he is a friend of mine, and I'm gonna be there right by his side when he is on the cover of Time. I'm riding the Ron English train. Where does it go? Riding the Ron English train to fortune and fame. So I go to the openings and look on the walls. You know it really isn't too bad for art. And I tell pretty girls Ron and I are this close because it touches their hearts. And I say, hey Ron, this is your best work yet. Artists always like that sort of lie. And I say, we've gotta do lunch real soon. You're the famous artist you can buy. The Ron English train. Where does it go? Riding the Ron English train to fortune and fame. Junkie kid, till he met a fella named Warhol. It isn't who you are in life, it's who you know, that's all. And I know Ron, and I pegged him as a guy who's gonna make it right to the top. And if I'm wrong, and he's not famous in 6 months, he's an artist that I'm gonna drop. I'm riding the Ron. Fortune and fame.
What do you tell the young artist today who's just starting out?
Usually I just say, just pick, you know, do exactly what you want to do and don't try to pander to people, because whatever you do, you get stuck doing it. You know, Roy Lichtenstein had to paint those goddamn Band-Aid dots for the rest of his life, you know? And I sure hope he liked them.
Right.
Because, I mean, you get trapped inside your own thing. And if you're doing something just to, if you're trying to get people what you think they want, you're going to be stuck giving them that for the rest of your life. But if you do exactly what you want, you're going to be stuck doing exactly what you want for the rest of your life. You know, Ted Nugent, I remember when I was a kid, I met him, I was at one of his concerts, and I actually took like a whole thing of speed, so I was speeding my fucking brains out. And I after the concert, he was like hanging out, so, you know, nobody was talking to him, so I just went up and started talking to him, and then I was having this long conversation with him, so I thought, well, hell, I'll ask him some life advice. And I said, I'm a young artist, like, what should I do? Just, do you have any advice for me? And he goes, kid, just do what you do till they like it. And I thought, you know, that kind of makes sense. Just do your thing, and eventually they'll come around. Don't try to come around to them. Let them come around to you, you know?
That's good advice. That's a very good answer. I think we struggle with that as artists across the board. We're always trying to figure out, why haven't they come to me? Why haven't they discovered me?
You know? Yeah, and you know, visual artists, it's always, it's like, oh, my God, you love Keith Haring. That fucking shit's so easy. I can just whack that shit out all day. And then you know, if somebody gets a lot of success, then they got a lot of imitators, you know?
Right. Tell me about the new series of work, new paintings. You were executing something based on a Picasso, a very famous Picasso. Well, you've executed that specific painting before.
I've done a lot of Guernicas, and I don't know how I got stuck on that. It's like I did some as kind of culture wars with all the Disney and Warner Brothers characters. And then I thought, I wonder what it would look like, you know, an aerial view. I wonder what it looked like from the point of view of the plane. And I couldn't figure out how to do that. So what I did is I made a big sculpture of Guernica. And then I just took a picture from the top of it. So
Where is it? Here?
No, it's at home. So I based a couple paintings on that, and then, you know, then I thought, well, how many different ways can I do this? You know, like after the World Trade Center, I painted this huge fire with the fish swimming all through the fire, and then there's then superimposed Guernica on top, and then, you know, you could see the World Trade Center. But I was thinking in terms, like with that, like it's like this is New York's this giant fishbowl. It's just like a bunch of cameras all focused in. So it's like these people are in a snuff film and they can't do anything about it. So I just wanted to make something about that. And, you know, Guernica obviously has, you know, it means something to people, you know?
Right.
I mean, people know what Guernica means, you know?
They know exactly. I don't know. Well, everyone, what do you think it means? I don't know.
Oh, it just means, basically it means it's about, you know, just unbridled power just fucking with innocent people. Just wholesale slaughter of innocent people is basically what that painting is about.
Right.
You know, for no purpose whatsoever, just because
you're an
asshole.
Well, this is the Spanish fascism, though.
Right.
During when,
right.
Like, but when Picasso painted it, the Germans actually
dropped the bombs. But it was like it wasn't a military target. They had a new idea of, let's just fucking wipe towns out.
Right.
You know, let's just bomb innocent people, because, you know, war tends to have rules. You know, I mean, now the rules are completely gone. You know, it's just like just attack anything. You know, the one I'm doing now, I was thinking they want me to do like a really huge one.
Right.
And I thought, well,
who's they?
Oh, it's the Station Museum in Houston.
Okay.
So I was sure there in the spring. But I was trying to think, what new could I do with it? And I was thinking, how could I make Guernica like a positive painting?
Right.
And said, let's make it the town of Guernica 5 minutes before the bombing. Oh. Well, all the colors are bright, and it's the same characters, but now they're still happy. They're not ripped to shreds yet,
right.
You know? And
smiles on the faces.
Right. And it's so, like, ostensibly, you know, like, here we are back at this point. It doesn't have to go that direction. It could go another direction now, you know? So
you're fucking with time now, Ron.
Fucking with time. But, you know, it's. But people will recognize the image, and I've taken away all the bad stuff from it. So I don't know. It's just, how many ways can you play with an image, you know? I thought of staging it with my kids, or, you know, you can just go on forever,
right. What's in store in the future? What new imagery do you think is ripe for co-oping?
Right now, I'm really trying to do my own characters for a while.
Okay.
And see how that works. And it's you know, because you make your living at it, you got to, you know, unfortunately, people want a painting of Mickey Mouse from you at some point, and they don't want a painting of your three-eyed bunny. But then I put out the three-eyed bunnies, and actually it's worked out. People love it. So,
right.
You know, and I did the same thing with my kids. I made all these paintings with my kids, and I said, well, you know, I mean, I wouldn't mind just keeping them, but, you know, people liked them, and they went for it. There was something about them that resonated with people, so.
You still haven't done a Dusty Wright cover, man. I'm pissed off. I've been pissed off for years.
You never asked me to, though.
I did.
Yeah.
A couple years ago. You were busy with music, man.
The people that seem to get stuff from me are the people that are most persistent.
Yeah, or they pay. They pay. Ron, I've got no money. Is that a problem?
Yeah.
And so concludes my interview with pop culture artist Ron English. I'd like to thank today's sponsors, Final Draft, the industry standard scriptwriting software. You can check them out at finaldraft.com, and our new sponsor, webhsp.com. They'll take care of all of your web hosting needs. This is Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch. We'll see you next time.